Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The House is expected to vote on a $900 billion military spending bill this week. The 3,000-page bill includes $8 billion more than what the Trump administration requested. Reuters reports that some Democrats threatened to stall the measure over Trump's use of the military in U.S. cities until Republican Senator Roger Wicker, chair of the Armed Services Committee, agreed to hold a hearing this week on that issue. Common Dreams points out that if this spending bill passes, it would push total military spending above $1 trillion. That includes the $150 billion in Pentagon funds included in the Trump GOP budget law enacted over the summer. But that has gotten very little media attention. The United States spends more on the military than the next nine countries combined, including China and Russia. So how did we get here? And what will it take to change this country's spending priorities? Today's guests, William Hartung and Ben Freeman, are out with a new book exploring those questions called The $1 trillion War Machine, How Runaway Military Spending Drives America into Foreign Wars and Bankrupts Us at Home. They write that more than half of the Pentagon budget goes to private firms, not military personnel, even as weapons company CEOs make $20 million per year or more. There are so many military families whose budgets are so stretched that they rely on food banks to make ends meet. There are also hundreds of thousands of veterans suffering from physical and psychological damage and high levels of suicide. William Hartung and Ben Freeman write that if the trillions that have been spent on weapons and war had been spent on domestic needs, American society would be transformed almost beyond imagination. William Hartung is Senior Research Fellow at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. They promote ideas that move U.S. foreign policy away from endless wars toward military restraint and diplomacy in the pursuit of international peace. Bill Hartung is an expert on the arms trade, Pentagon spending and strategy, and nuclear weapons policy. He's the author of Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex, and co-author of the new book, The $1 trillion War Machine. Hi, Bill. Thanks so much for joining us again, and huge thanks and congratulations on your new book.
Thank you. It's great to be back. It's been a while, but unfortunately, we still got to deal with these things. So,
yes, we do. And it couldn't be more timely. Thank you so much. We're also joined by Ben Freeman, director of the Democratizing Foreign Policy Program at the Quincy Institute and co-author of The $1 trillion War Machine. Hi, Ben. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, it's great to be with you.
Well, it's great to have you. It's great to have both of you. Bill, as you know, we do fairly regular shows about the Pentagon budget, and yet what you point out in your book is hardly debated in this country at a time when so many people are struggling to make ends meet. As you point out in your book, the big five contractors alone, Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, which is now RTX, Boeing, General Dynamics, and Northrop Grumman split an astonishing $2 trillion in Pentagon contracts in the two decades after the 9/11 attacks. And the spending spree continues with this new military budget bill. Why is it that at a time when so many people are struggling, why aren't these issues debated? Why aren't these facts talked about in the major media?
Well, one thing is they often take their cue from whether there's a debate in Washington, and Congress rarely debates this. I mean, there was a hearing on what our nuclear posture should be, and the majority of senators talked about weapons that were built in their state, not a policy to keep us from, you know, having a nuclear war. And when Senator Warren asked what this would all cost, the co-authors of this report said, oh, that doesn't matter, we need this stuff. And the co-chair was a former lobbyist for Northrop Grumman, which is the biggest company profiting from all this. So, if you can't get a debate in Congress, a lot of the media is not going to cover it. And then, of course, there's a lot of mythic narratives that are funded through think tanks to get support from contractors in the Pentagon, which Ben has done amazing work on. They're shifting Hollywood movies, so every weapon is always amazing. and every pilot is a hero. They've interacted with the gaming industry. They actually use the Army gaming team to recruit young gamers to work with them. So they're increasingly funding university research, not just science but social science. And then I think finally, a lot of people wonder if we can do anything about this, which is they feel that on many fronts. So there's also not a like a robust ongoing movement. So you know, it's up to the media to really seek these stories out and elevate them. And there's some incentives not to do so, because especially now in this kind of neo-Cold War environment. So all these things come into play, but there's a lot of great journalists. A lot of what we do, we learn from journalists, but many of them, their editors kind of keep them from going deeper, or they're doing short-term stories. So, you know, we need independent media to really get the conversation going.
Ben, to Bill's point about how there is very little debate in Congress about these issues, I was struck by a line that I read in a Reuters piece about this latest spending bill. And here's what it says: considered must-pass legislation, the massive spending bill is one of the few major pieces of legislation that Congress passes every year, and lawmakers take pride in having passed it annually for more than six decades.
Right. And the great irony is that this bill, the National Defense Authorization Act, better known as the Defense Policy Bill, it does get passed every year. Yet the one thing DOD has never passed in any year is an audit of all that spending. You know, year after year, the Department of Defense goes through this audit process, gets to the end of it, and the auditors realize they can't actually audit this agency. They can't actually keep track of where all this money is going. And I think that should be especially troubling to people, given that this is the largest government bureaucracy. This is the largest bureaucracy in the world. And yet taxpayers are told every year that the DOD itself can't tell you where all of that money is going.
And it's also interesting because I found a piece last month and did not hear about this until I started doing some research on this because of your book. So here's a piece from Reuters, November 14th. Large defense companies have conned the U.S. military into buying expensive equipment when cheaper commercial options would have been available, according to U.S. Army Secretary Dan Driscoll. Driscoll told reporters, "The defense industrial base broadly, and the primes in particular, conned the American people and the Pentagon and the Army." He added that, in part, it was the government's fault for creating incentive structures that encourage companies to charge astronomical prices. Previously, the Army said that a Lockheed-owned Sikorsky Black Hawk helicopter screen control knob that cost $47,000 could be manufactured independently for just $15. So this is head spinning, $47,000, but it could be manufactured for just 15 bucks. So Ben, here's a U.S. Army secretary saying this. So why didn't this get more attention?
Yeah, it's a great question. I can't really tell you why it didn't get more attention, but I do give credit to the Army Secretary for this. You know, Dan Driscoll, he comes out of the tech space, the venture capital space, and he has been an ardent critic of the way that the Department of Defense does business. And he's really challenging the old guard, the primes, and frankly, the price gouging that they've done for years. I mean, beyond years, for decades. You know, I previously worked at the Project on Government Oversight more than a decade ago, in fact. And, you know, when I worked at POGO, we were pointing out issues like this then. And POGO actually got its start in the 80s, you know, revealing the $1,000 toilet seat and the $600 hammer that DOD was charging even in 1980s dollars. And so this is an issue that's been going back for decades, and it hasn't really been challenged. In fact, the primes have just been kind of consolidating their power, and they've effectively been getting everybody to buy into this by hiring lobbyists and making campaign contributions to members of Congress. I think Driscoll's right. This has been a con job, but unfortunately, everybody's been in on it, so no one's done anything about it.
And one
And
of the
Bill,
media issues,
oh, go
oh,
ahead,
sorry.
Bill.
One of the differences in the media is that in the 80s, there was, televised hearings about this. It was fodder for late night comics, all over the press. And, Herb Bloch, the Washington Post reporter, had a, every time he portrayed the Reagan Secretary of Defense, Caspar Weinberger, he had a toilet seat around his neck. And Congress actually did sort of level out the Reagan buildup, partly because of that. Things that happen today that are even worse, they just don't get that ripple effect in the media.
And once in a while, you do see a major investigation in the mainstream. In 2023, 60 Minutes had an incredible investigation that found weapons contractors like Lockheed and Raytheon overcharged the Pentagon on almost everything the Department of Defense buys with taxpayer dollars every year. I mean, this was an in-depth report. Five senators, including Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, called on the Defense Department to launch an investigation into the long history of price gouging, but it pretty much went nowhere. So what about that, Bill? You've got 60 Minutes doing this incredible investigation, but hardly anything came of it.
Well, I think, when the senators tried to do something, what happens, it gets chewed up by the process. So price gouging, partly because the contractors don't supply transparency about what stuff actually costs versus what they want to charge. There's fewer contracting officers to keep tabs on them. In some cases, the companies own the software to fix the thing. They don't let the government do it, so they've got the government over a barrel. And then, every senator has many, many assignments. A lot of their stuff is done by young staffers who just can't keep up. And sometimes they have to turn to lobbyists, of which the industry has 1,000, almost two for every member of Congress, just to fill them in on what's in these bills that are thousands and thousands of pages. But then there's still the question of how do we generate more public pressure? And I think people feel like they used to say, well, nuclear weapons is an existential threat, which is true. But if you're not sure your kid can get to school without being shot at, that's an existential threat. Not being able to put food on your table is an existential threat. Being afraid you're going to be kidnapped and sent to El Salvador to some horrid prison. So people just have so many things flying at them. Like, how do we bring those concerns together into a more powerful pressure? And it's hard to do, but I think this is the moment that we have to.
And as we talk about the big five contractors during today's show, again, RTX, which is Lockheed Martin and Raytheon, Boeing, General Dynamics, and Northrop Grumman, it's important to point out, and we learn about this in your book, one of the most enduring elements of the Clinton defense policy, as you write, was the decision to encourage and subsidize defense industry mergers, a move that opened the way for the creation of giant firms like Lockheed and Raytheon. Defense industry consolidation ultimately gave arms companies even more bargaining power. The ranks of major defense contractors shrank from 51 to just five. And this is really important to point out, Ben, because when you look at what happened under the Clinton administration, they allowed the major consolidation of the media. I mean, that's when we saw the radio industry really consolidating. And that's another reason why we are where we are with the corporate media here today. And then when you look at what Clinton did with consolidation with weapons companies, can you talk more about that?
Right. I think you're spot on. There's a theory behind that went something like, if we consolidate, there'll be better efficiencies, buying power, sort of the Walmart idea, right? Buy in bulk and we'll save the taxpayer some bucks kind of argument. But what happened in reality, sort of the opposite of that. We effectively created a near monopoly where it's not quite a complete monopoly. There is some competition between those firms at the top, but those firms year in and year out, they get nearly half of all the contracting dollars that are coming out of the Department of Defense. And that's that's over $100 billion. You know, just those five firms are taking home from DoD every single year. And so when you talk about a Department of Defense that has over 1,000 contractors that it works with, and just five of them are getting half the pie, you know, that starts to look, you know, a lot like very non-competitive practices. And the flip side of it is what we're seeing, because those corporations are competing for profits and for revenues. They're doing a lot of things to just drive up their profit, their stock prices, drive up their revenues that do nothing to help the warfighter or to help keep us safe. One of the biggest examples of that are stock buybacks. You know, Lockheed Martin in some years will have billions of dollars, that literally takes billions of dollars of its revenue and uses it to buy back its own stock to drive up that stock price. Now, that's a huge benefit to anybody who's holding Lockheed stock, but it does literally nothing to help keep us safe. And I think, you know, because of that, people should be very concerned about these issues.
And Ben talked about the rationale back then. They said they were going to save money. People like me questioned it. Lawrence Korb, who was an official in the Reagan administration, questioned it. Bernie Sanders pointed out that they were laying off workers, but they were subsidizing golden parachutes for people like Norman Augustine, who put together Lockheed Martin out of 22 different companies. And Augustine said, look, post-Cold War, there's going to be a little dip. 7 years from now, it's going to go up again, and we're going to be dominant, which they've been ever since. They get 40 to 50 billion a year from the Pentagon, and many years more than our State Department. So what was supposed to be an efficiency measure just gave more power to these companies, and they've used it to the hilt.
Today, we are joined by Bill Hartung and Ben Freeman. They're out with a new book called The Trillion Dollar War Machine: How Runaway Military Spending Drives America into Foreign Wars and Bankrupts Us at Home. They write that if the trillions that had been spent on weapons had been spent on domestic needs, U.S. society would be transformed almost beyond imagination. Bill Hartung is Senior Research Fellow at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. They promote ideas that move U.S. foreign policy away from endless war toward military restraint and diplomacy in the pursuit of international peace. Ben Freeman is director of the Democratizing Foreign Policy Program at the Quincy Institute, and they're co-authors of The Trillion Dollar War Machine. If you have any questions for Bill and Ben about their book, they did so much research on how we got to this place, how this money is spent. They talked about also the Poor People's Campaign, and we've done a lot of shows about the Poor People's Campaign. What would happen if the United States really shifted spending priorities? What would it take to get there? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Let's talk about how you open your book. You've got a quote here from candidate Donald Trump in September 2024 at a rally in Mosinee, Wisconsin, just 6 weeks before going on to defeat Kamala Harris. He said, "I will expel the warmongers. We have these people. They want to go to war all the time. You know why? Missiles are $2 million a piece. That's why. They love to drop missiles all over the place." And then Trump said, "I had no wars." So he ran on this platform to be anti-war, and a lot of people believed him. We'll also talk about the role that the Biden administration played in arming Israel. And we'll talk about the role that Gaza played, because that's really not getting much attention when people look back to find out what happened during this election. So, Ben, do you want to talk about why you both decided to start with that quote from Trump?
Yeah, that quote really struck both of us as being a powerful testament to, you know, a presidential candidate to say, because it was so unusual to have any presidential candidate come out and that directly challenge the military industrial complex. You know, if you're a CEO of Lockheed Martin or Northrop Grumman or any of these other big companies, you hear that. That's got to scare you. You know, that's got to be a little bit frightening. But we led with that because what we saw President Trump do once he came into office was really the opposite of that. And he started this, you know, very early on. You know, of course, now we know he's, you know, he talked about not dropping bombs on the campaign trail, and now he is dropping bomb, his Department of Defense is at least dropping bombs on, you know, fishermen off the coast of Venezuela. And you know, many other places around the world too. You know, we're fueling and helping conflicts all over the place. And so it's the contrast that really struck us, where to have somebody come out so hard against the military-industrial complex on the campaign trail, and then when he took office to do the exact opposite. And that's what really led us to go through the history of presidents. And to be fair, this is a bipartisan book. We take swipes at both parties because when we looked back at history, we saw the exact same playbook from both Democrats and Republicans going back for decades, you know, whether it was Biden on the campaign trail or Obama or George W. Bush before them. We just saw this over and over again, and it led us to see this clear pattern that it doesn't matter who's in the White House, the military-industrial complex always seems to win, unfortunately.
And
And
Trump
what
gave
would
away
you?
the. Oh, sorry.
Well, because you, Bill, you wrote a piece in The Nation in September, Trump is no, quote, president of peace.
Yes, and he gave away the game in his first term because, you know, similarly, before he came in, he was criticizing the companies. They charged too much. I'm going to, you know, put them in line. The companies were nervous. Then his first foreign trip was to Saudi Arabia, and he wanted to offer them a humongous arms package. So, for example, Jared Kushner called up the head of Lockheed Martin and says, you know, could you give us this missile defense system at a discount, like, you know, $15 billion instead of $18 billion, so they could assemble this package. Then Trump goes there. He comes back and says, you know, I'm the deal maker. I'm looking after you. We're going to get 500,000 jobs from these sales, which was vastly exaggerated. So they went from being a target, these companies, to being basically a political partner. And even when Jamal Khashoggi was murdered by the Saudi regime, he put out a statement that said, you know, it's a terrible thing, but I'm not going to cut back because I don't want to hurt our wonderful defense contractors. Now, of course, he's deeply involved with the Silicon Valley tech group, which, as Ben said, is shaking it up. It may be more efficient than the Big Five, which is a low bar, but a lot of them are very hawkish. They're very vocal about the need to go to war. They say we don't need government. They're going to get rid of all kinds of, you know, scrutiny of their systems. And they're basically saying, trust us. And I don't think that's anything we want to do. If they create something that's useful, they should be a vendor. You know, the government buys it, that's it. They shouldn't be trying to influence our foreign policy, our budget, our worldview. You know, they're not masters of the universe the way they think they are, but a lot of people support them because they do these, you know, interesting things with tech.
And also, before we go to break, Bill, this is so important to talk about because things are moving so quickly. It almost feels like whiplash, given what this administration is doing. You wrote another piece in, I think it was, let's see, in The Nation, but it originally appeared at Tom Dispatch. The bill that the Republicans passed, which once again gave major tax cuts to the wealthy and corporations, added another $150 billion to the Pentagon budget. And yet that piece of the bill really did not get much media attention at all.
No, and you know, there's always been a trade-off between domestic and Pentagon spending. But for some years, it was somewhat, you know, moderated because a lot of programs were put on, you know, debt. But now, with the deep tax cuts and the big Pentagon increases and this so-called big, beautiful, ugly bill, people are going to be hurting in a way that we haven't seen in a long time, including programs that were supposed to be sacrosanct, not just Medicaid, but other healthcare programs that'll affect all Americans, including the president's supporters, cutting nutrition programs. So this might filter down to more opposition, but a lot of people don't really know how the budget works. Like a colleague of mine in the Senate said, you know, different states have different names for Medicare. And there was that famous statement during the Affordable Care Act debate where this woman said, keep your government hands off my Medicare. So there's not a lot of idea of what the government does that's positive that helps people, but there's a lot of criticism really across the board about how government can't do anything. And that makes it easier for people like these tech folks to swoop in and say, we'll fix it.
We're going to take a quick break. Today, we are joined by Bill Hartung and Ben Freeman. They're out with a new book, The $1 Trillion War Machine: How Runaway Military Spending Drives America into Foreign Wars and Bankrupts Us at Home. After the break, we will talk about how President Biden stepped up arms and military aid to Israel, which left another opening for Donald Trump. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we're spending the hour with Bill Hartung and Ben Freeman. We're talking about their new book, The $1 Trillion War Machine: How Runaway Military Spending Drives America into Foreign Wars and Bankrupts Us at Home. They write that if the trillions that have been spent on weapons and war had been spent on domestic needs, our society would be transformed almost beyond imagination. So what would it take for that to happen? You can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. And let's go to a caller who's got a question about that. Let's hear from Mary in Berkeley. Hi, Mary. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for picking up my call, and thank your guest for writing that amazing book. I have a friend who is a conscientious objector and does not pay taxes because of the war machine, but it really puts her sort of at disadvantage in many ways. She can't own property, et cetera, et cetera. And I wondered if there's any legal way to withhold your taxes or the taxes that go to the war machine, in escrow or something like that, or if that is just unknown.
It's not that I'm aware of. I mean, there's a long, proud history of tax resistance, including a guy named Randy Keeler, who was one of the founders of the Freeze campaign in the 80s, who lost his home and suffered all that. Some people would argue, well, some of the money goes to domestic things, some to the military. But my sense is, I wouldn't necessarily have the courage to do that or to, do civil disobedience. But I think those people are inspirational. If they can take that risk, I can certainly write another article. I can speak out. I can try to do things that are useful to folks who are trying to change this. So, that kind of stuff doesn't get the attention it did, when the Berrigan brothers burned the draft files in the 60s. But it's still, I think, kind of a moral compass that should inspire others to take action.
I similarly, I don't know of a legal route for that. But I do think, having folks who do that, it could serve as an educational opportunity for people to realize, those who are paying their taxes, to recognize just how much of your taxes are going to the war machine. And if you break it down by the numbers, we have some of these stats in the book. You're talking an average taxpayer, just an average taxpayer, about $2,000 of their tax money every single year is going to these contractors, just these big contractors that we're talking about here. That's not even all of, military or national security spending. If you start adding that number in, you're starting to talk about $4,000 and $5,000 for just your average taxpayer. And so we're all, whether we like it or not, we're all buying into this system through our taxes.
And when the government goes to war, it doesn't calculate what's going to happen to our veterans. The VA has tripled its budget since the start of the post-9/11 wars, and they're not even close to meeting the needs of our vets. So that's really a consequence of what the Pentagon does, but it's in a separate budget line. And likewise, ICE and the crackdowns are part of Homeland Security, some of the military aids in the State Department. So if you think about what our colleagues at National Priorities Project called the militarized budget, it might be 1.5 times or more what we're spending now. So that's a huge chunk of the budget that might be used for other things. And as Ben pointed out, it's not working on any level, regardless if you're a defense reformer, you're for peace, you're for disarmament. Basically, it's done because of money. The Pentagon can't even get rid of weapons it doesn't want because members want to keep the stuff in their district. And that's no way to have a strategy. If your strategy is X and the way you buy stuff is based on pork barrel politics, it's almost impossible for those things to align. So, I mean, our hope is people that are upset about this for all different reasons, because it drives the deficit, because it's dysfunctional in terms of rational strategy, because it's stealing money from other needs, would at least agree we have to change the system and make it more open so people can, we can at least have that debate about what our country should be about. I think that would be a step forward.
And this is an important point. I'm looking right now at a spending graph from the National Priorities Project, and veterans benefits are a different line item. So when we say military spending bill, it's easy to assume that that includes money for veterans benefits. At a time when, and this is just horrific, and this deserves more attention, but according to the 2024 National Veterans Suicide Prevention Report, 17 veterans are committing suicide every day. I mean, this is just such a, it's so hard to wrap your head around this.
Yeah, it's horrific. And I you know, this is one of the things right now that that just drives me nuts. And one of the reasons why we wrote this book, the war machine is not working for anyone, including veterans. Because, you know, as we document in the book, we have this $1 trillion budget for the war machine at the same time that we're cutting VA benefits. You know, the VA staff was gutted by DOGE. You know, Elon Musk's initiative, you know, came through the Veterans Affairs Administration and cut a lot of personnel from them, including a lot of veterans themselves became unemployed because of DOGE there. And yet we still have, we have these extraordinary high rates of veteran suicide. You know, veterans' food insecurity is an enormous issue. About one in four veterans are facing food insecurity right now, too. So we have this just litany of issues that our veterans are facing. And yet the big contractors working for the Pentagon are seeing record-setting profits and have CEOs who are making $10, $20, and $30 million a year. You know, the contrast and the hypocrisy could not be more stark.
Mm. And some of the vets are pushing back, but the generals are going straight into industry and cashing in. People have been in war, or have groups like Common Defense, About Face, Veterans for Peace. Even some conservative vets got together and said, you know, we got to get rid of this blank check for war that was created after 9/11. But I don't think a lot of people realize that, because a lot of the spending is based on what's being done for the troops. The troops are being sent to wars that are unwinnable. We're not taking care of them when they come back. I think if that penetrated with more folks, they would question this whole enterprise a bit more, you know, adamantly.
Actually, on Veterans Day, we had a number of veterans on who were protesting in many, many cities across the country. Once again, I just have to repeat this. It didn't get much media attention. And then recently, veterans held a three-day protest in Washington to call for the impeachment of Trump. They're calling for the National Guard to get out of cities. They were hosting, I'm not sure if they're doing it now because it's so cold, but they were hosting a 24/7 sit-in in Washington, D.C. at Union Station to bring up these issues. But again, it's just not getting that much media attention. And these vets really, in many cases, are on the front lines of these protests.
Yes, well, I think we're at the point, I mean, I do my best to get in the mainstream media, but a lot of times it's just kind of article from the point of view of the establishment. And then in paragraph 32 says, oh yeah, there's this guy, Bill Hartung, who disagrees. So it's not really the framing of the article. And I realize that that's not sufficient, but we do at least have an independent media, which can go a little deeper. But people get their news all over the place. They can't sometimes distinguish disinformation from real information. So we have to build up those independent outlets. We have to educate people as to why they're an important place to get news. And the younger generation is more skeptical of intervention. Of course, they're, you know, the backbone of the ceasefire movement. And yet people who should know better, like Hillary Clinton, says, oh, these kids, they don't know the history. Well, their history is a lot more honorable than hers is. She voted for the Iraq War. She supported the dismemberment of Libya. A lot of these students are also from the region. They know exactly what's happening. And so not only was it disrespectful, it was just shameless for her to say, well, we're this elite that knows what we're doing. Because if you look at the history of our last 20 years of war, we obviously need new leadership. You know, the folks who have done this are not the people to steer the ship going forward.
Today, we're speaking with Bill Hartung and Ben Freeman about their new book, The $1 Trillion War Machine, How Runaway Military Spending Drives America into Foreign Wars and Bankrupts Us at Home. Bill Hartung is Senior Research Fellow at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. Ben Freeman is Director of the Democratizing Foreign Policy Program at the Quincy Institute. You can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at KALW.org. Let's spend some time talking about what has happened in Gaza. And when you hear people talk about why Trump is back in the White House, there's a lot of conversations about how he spent so much time promising people that he would bring costs down. Of course, immigration played a huge role in his campaign. At the RNC convention, you saw people with these mass deportation now signs. But you don't hear that much about the role that Gaza played in this election. And in your book, again, in the intro, you write that President Biden stepped up arms and military aid to Israel, even as it committed what many independent experts have described as a genocide in Gaza, and even as Americans' public support for Israel's military actions cratered. Biden urged Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to avoid hitting civilians and to stop blocking humanitarian aid shipments, but it failed to do the one thing that would have gotten Israel's attention: cut off U.S. arms and military aid to Israel as leverage to get it to support a ceasefire in Gaza and to end its escalation of the war into Lebanon and Iran. And all of this left it open for Trump to offer one of the most fiery denunciations of the arms lobby in living memory. And as a result of all of this, I mean, of course, there were other factors. A lot of people either sat out the election, voted for a third party candidate, or voted for Trump because of the horror that has been happening in Gaza. So can you talk more about this? And what are your thoughts about how this all played out and how we should be talking about it now?
Well, I think the Biden circle was deluding themselves because they said, oh, you know, these students will come around as we get closer to the election. They realize the choice. But, you know, students picketing in March, talking about Genocide Joe, are not going to vote for him in the fall. They miscalculated, you know, what happened in Michigan, where there was a large Palestinian population. And I think, you know, all their professions of being for a rules-based international order were just blatant hypocrisy, given what they were allowing to have happen in Israel, Gaza. And I think also for some people, you know, Biden said, oh, the way to influence Netanyahu is to hold him close. And that completely failed. So, you know, Biden, among other things, looked weak. So all these things played against them. But they were kind of in this mindset, you know, Israel right or wrong, partly because of an understandable reaction to the Holocaust and the idea that this was a sanctuary for Jews around the world. But Netanyahu is not doing Israel any favors. Whatever progress they had made building relations with other states have gone away. They've become, in the eyes of many, a pariah state. So that's not a good basis to keep Israel as a viable country. And of course, to talk between Israel and Palestine now is going to be so hard to get interlocutors on both sides that can be trusted. So, you know, President Biden was kind of set in his mind after 50 years of supporting Israel and because of the pressures from AIPAC, and he wasn't able to step out, as many Jewish Americans were, not just younger ones, but, you know, they were tarred as anti-Semitic. And, you know, Mike Johnson went to Columbia to talk to the Jewish students. I said, which ones? The ones against the war, or the ones for the war? And of course, he has a sterling record of anti-Semitism towards Jews in the United States. And that hypocrisy was never pointed out. So basically that argument was weaponized against people trying to stop a genocide because, you know, some student said something incorrect, which really, okay, fine. But stopping the genocide has got to be the priority.
I think
just, Ben, before you jump in, I just want to add One data point here that deserves more attention. The Institute for Middle East Understanding Policy Project conducted a poll with YouGov, and they asked voters that voted for Biden in 2020 that did not vote for Harris, asked why. 29% said ending Israel's violence in Gaza.
Mm-hmm. I think that's indicative of it. And that's indicative of, I think, a deep-seated problem in the Democratic Party right now. For a long time, I think there's been this myth that the Democratic Party is the party of peace. And there's a lot of folks who vote Democratic because they want a more peaceful foreign policy. They want a more restrained foreign policy. They want less wars. And what they've actually gotten from the Democratic Party is a very different story. And you know, Biden's presidency was just the latest example. You know, we talk about this in the book, going back for decades of Democratic presidents. You know, you see this going back to Jimmy Carter and, you know, Obama, too. You know, we might love Obama for a variety of reasons, but at the end of the day, Obama oversaw the surge in Iraq and Afghanistan. Obama actually was president during the highest military budget that we've had since World War II, controlling for inflation. You know, it's extraordinary when you look at, you know, talking about the Democratic Party as the party of peace. That is just not borne out by what Democratic presidents have done. And I think that really came to a head in the 2024 election and, you know, arguably cost Harris the election by, you know, having Trump having the rhetoric that he did about Israel, Gaza, about the warmongers. A lot of those, you know, folks who might have been centrist are, you know, Democratic leaning voters who were just dismayed by this party who wasn't actually doing peaceful things. They might have heard what Trump said and crossed over there. And it could very well have crossed Harris the election.
And, well, and you know, the Democrats were complacent because the conventional wisdom is foreign policy doesn't decide elections. It's, you know, pocketbook issues. But this was so egregious, being paid with our tax dollars, that it was a different situation. This could not stand in the minds of many people.
And you point out in your book, The $1 trillion War Machine, that what happened in Gaza would not have been able to happen without support from the United States. And it's just so important because this has fallen off of headlines. I mean, it's the BBC reports on it in their top news, and NPR has a correspondent in Gaza, Anas Baba, who's been doing incredible work because foreign journalists are still not allowed to go inside Gaza. And so these Palestinian journalists have been just doing nonstop incredible work. And The Guardian has a piece just a couple days ago called Bloodshed Was Supposed to Stop, No Sign of Normal Life as Gaza's Killing and Misery Grind On. So in a place of 2.2 million people, to think that over 65,000 Palestinians have been killed and they're still being killed under this so-called ceasefire, you point out in the book that this would not be possible without support from the United States.
Well, no, actually President Biden was going to investigate whether our weapons would be used to violate human rights. Well, the entire Israeli Air Force is U.S. supplied planes, tens of thousands of missiles and bombs, Palantir helping them speed up the bombing and the targeting. So what a sham. What's to investigate? It was obvious. And the president could have any moment stopped it, and he chose not to.
Yeah, it's just absurd that he was going to, you know, quote, investigate this. Israel is the number one foreign recipient of U.S. arms and has been for decades. You know, their military is made possible by our military, by our Pentagon contractors. And so if they're committing war crimes, we are absolutely complicit in that.
There's a new documentary that I have not watched yet, but I'd like to do a show about this called Breaking Ranks Inside Israel's War. And a number of Israeli soldiers are speaking out, just like soldiers did, American soldiers in Iraq, and saying some of the same things. Daniel, the commander of the IDF tank unit, said, "If you want to shoot without restraint, you can." They basically said that there were no innocents in Gaza. And if anyone wants to watch this, it's called Breaking Ranks Inside Israel's War. Today, we are spending the hour with Bill Hartung and Ben Freeman to talk about their new book, The $1 trillion War Machine, How Runaway Military Spending Drives America into Foreign Wars and Bankrupts Us at Home. Let's take a few callers and then we'll get Bill and Ben to respond. Let's go to Maurice in Oakland. Hi, Maurice. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning. Lest we forget, it was the Liberal Democrats, Kennedy and Johnson, that brought us the debacle in Vietnam. And it was the Liberal Democrats that brought us 57, now coming up on 58 years of a brutal military occupation in the West Bank, in addition to 18 years of a blockade. And it's not the military-industrial complex. It's the congressional military-industrial complex. And Rose, to paraphrase one of your late and most, one of my most favorite guests, I think his name is Robert McKenzie, rich media, poor democracy. And the only solution is mandatory public financing of all elections. That could take 100 years. I'm prepared to wait. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, Maurice. You're talking about Robert McChesney, the late, great, incredible journalism professor who was such an advocate for independent media and the and public financing of media. So thank you for the call. We're going to take another caller and then we'll get responses. Let's go to Harry in San Francisco. Hi, Harry.
Yes, I wonder if your guest could address the new generation of nuclear weapons and other makers for other aspirants to make weapons and technology for the American military-industrial complex. For example, Palantir inked a $10 billion enterprise agreement with the U.S. Army this year.
Yeah, thank you, Harry. In fact, I hope that Bill and Ben will come back to the show because we really just scratched the surface of their book. But you do have a lot of information in your book about today's tech industry and the contracts that they're hoping to get and how close they are with Trump and his sons. We don't have that much time, but Ben, can you talk a bit about this? What struck you the most about your research on this topic?
Yeah, I think I'm actually going to leave the defense tech comment to Bill. He's done some extraordinary work on that. But I would like to tackle the first caller's comment, which I think is an excellent comment about the campaign finance system. And I completely agree. It is the military industrial congressional complex. And what helps it to keep going and to be self-sustaining is that these giant Pentagon contractors, they fund the campaigns. They're some of the largest donors to key congressional offices. Like we've been talking about the defense policy bill right now, they are the top donors to the top people on the committees that are putting that bill together. And so because of that, you know, we know that your top funders can oftentimes dictate or at least cajole some of the work that members of Congress are doing. So shifting and, you know, cutting that down at the very least, or, you know, as your caller was implying, going to a full publicly funded campaign finance system, that would really cut off a considerable source of power that Pentagon contractors have over members of Congress. That's one of the reforms that we advocate for in the book, along with other things like revolving door restrictions. But it's a very good point that, you know, moving to that would help to slow down the military industrial complex.
The tech issue, on the one hand, they're creating competition. They actually had to sue to get fair bidding for Palantir and SpaceX. But there's two problems. One is this is unproven technology that could make war more likely, that could take humans out of the loop. So it's got to be regulated, and that's not happening yet. But the other thing is the ideology of the leaders. The Palantir folks, Palmer Luckey, Elon Musk, are almost spoiling for war. You know, Luckey went on 60 Minutes and said, there's going to be a war with China in 2 years, and we're going to bury them because of our technology. He also said, you know, 8 years into the war, we'll have more ammunition than they do. they're a nuclear-armed country. There's not going to be an eight-year war with China. But, of course, Palmer Luckey was not trained on foreign policy. He was trained on making virtual reality goggles. So, you know, as I said before, we have to treat these folks like vendors. And there's been various waves of resistance in Silicon Valley, including Google at one point saying they wouldn't make military equipment. Of course, there was a loophole, which is they were making technology that was integrated into military equipment by others. But the days when Silicon Valley said, we're making more money commercially, we don't deal with the Pentagon bureaucracy, our workforce is not so thrilled about doing this, seemed to be over. And I think, you know, Peter Thiel of Palantir was kind of the leader in this. But now there's a whole new ideology, which is that, you know, the militarized tech folks are the new patriots. They call themselves the founders, as if they were the founders of the country. One of their chief ideologists wrote a piece saying, what does it take to be a founder? You have to have this God-given belief that there's something and you're the only one who can do it. You know, Peter Thiel wants to live forever. Elon Musk wants mass colonization of space. These people should have nothing to do with determining our foreign policy. They're also deeply anti-democratic. That one of their gurus said, you know, democracy is pointless and is inefficient and so forth. So at the same time we fight the ideology, we have to take the technology and just regulate it. What is it good for? What isn't it good for? Technology is not a miracle. You know, it doesn't necessarily win wars, as we saw in Iraq and Afghanistan. So if we go down that wishful thinking road again, not to mention things like Golden Dome, it's going to cost us a lot of money. Our military is going to get weaker. Our veterans are going to suffer. Our society is not going to be strong, healthy, educated, which is the actual source of strength, not building gadgets.
Bill Hartung is Senior Research Fellow at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. Ben Freeman is Director of the Democratizing Foreign Policy Program at the Quincy Institute. And their new book is The $1 trillion War Machine, How Runaway Military Spending Drives America into Foreign Wars and Bankrupts Us at Home. Bill and Ben, thank you so much for your work, and we'd love to have you back to continue this discussion.
Yes, and thank you for having this discussion. I think people should emulate you.
This has been wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.